Welcome, everybody, to episode 67 of the Average Jake Firefighter Podcast. I'm your host, Robbie Owens. Really excited to have the guest on that we have today, Kyle Samsing from Newport News Fire Department in Virginia, and also of Pragmatic Fire Consulting. He is one of the most unique thinkers I think I've ever come across in the fire service. I've had the opportunity to go back and forth with him on a myriad of topics, either in person, over social media, all of those things. He's attended some of the same conferences I've been to. Of course, he's right down the road from where I live in Virginia. So just, have had the opportunity to interact with Kyle throughout my fire service career, especially within the last probably 10 years. Have had dinner with him at FDIC and just, again, one of the most unique thinkers I've ever come across in the fire service. And, we don't always agree on every topic, but I believe every time we've talked about a topic, and I don't even want to use the word debate, it is always very civil. It always is very like, okay, well, we just don't agree on this, right? And let's move on. So just really, really excited to have him on here. He has he's a unique thinker, and he has a unique take on fireground decision-making, experience, and just kind of all things fire service. So I'm really, really excited to have him on. But before we get into that, just I usually do this at the end of the episode, and I'm going to rehash it at the end of the episode as well, but I just want to thank all the people who make this possible for me to continue to do this podcast. It is a labor of love. It's not easy. I don't make any money off of it or anything like that, and so just to have people continue to support the podcast and support me doing it is, to be quite honest, it's very refreshing. That's not always been the case. That's not always been the mode of operation here at the Average Jake Firefighter Podcast, is having people support you no matter what. And so just some great, great people, starting with my wife and kids. They encourage me to do a podcast. Like, my kids are like, hey, Dad, have noticed on, you haven't dropped a new episode of the podcast here lately. What's up? My wife, always very encouraging. And just some great people like Vanguard Safety Wear, TacticalWorksheet.com, IDLH Technology, Taylor's Tins, Vanguard Safety Wear, like all these things. And of course, the Fireground Commander Conference that we're going to be doing May 8th, 9th, and 10th at the Henrico Theater. My good friends, Benjamin Martin, Taylor Goodman, myself, and all the other people who help us put on the conference. Just fantastic, fantastic groups of people that continue to encourage me and, give me the oomph and the kick in the butt to continue to get out here and record and hopefully just, continue the mission of the Average Jake Firefighter Podcast that we've done now for 67 episodes and try to give people a platform to speak their mind in the fire service or to share their fire service thoughts and musings and wisdom and everything in between and give people a platform that I thought that I was never afforded when I was coming up in the fire service. So I just want to give a big shout out to all of those people. We'll rehash some of that at the end of the episode, but let's not belabor the point anymore. Let's get to this interview with Kyle Samsing. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Average Jake Firefighter Podcast. Really excited to have on Kyle Samsing today. As we talked about in the intro, Kyle and I have, bumped into each other throughout our fire service journeys. He's not too far down the road from me, from where I live in Virginia, firefighter and where he lives. And so just, we've met each other at FDIC. I don't even want to call it debates, but we've discussed various a myriad of topics in the fire service. And Kyle's a very unique thinker, and he has a very unique perspective on the fire service. And I think it's valuable to share those different opinions and different things. But one of the things I can say, and I think Kyle would agree with that, is that we've always ended very civilly, right? Like, it's never been even when we don't disagree, when we don't agree with each other, which I think we agree more than we disagree, to be quite honest. But even when we don't agree with each other, it's usually we end very civilly, just like, okay, well, we don't agree. Goodbye. And we move on. But Kyle, thanks for coming on the Average Jake Firefighter Podcast. Really excited to have you on this episode today.
I appreciate you having me. It's been a while since we've caught up, so I'm looking forward to talking a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. So, again, like we talked about, we're going to talk about some of your views on fireground decision-making, especially fireground decision-making, because you're making what I think is huge strides in that arena, rather,
talking about the OODA loop and how to incorporate the teachings of John Boyd into fireground decision making. I really want to dive into that. But first, in case the listeners of the podcast don't know who you are or have never heard you speak or don't follow you on social media or things of that nature, give kind of a background of your experience and just kind of how you got involved in the fire service.
So I've been in the fire service for 17 or 18 years now. Started early on, didn't really do a whole lot there, but I had applications in, went before the board and stuff at the Aetna Hose, Hook, and Ladder in Newark, Delaware in about 2001 when I was in college. That kind of flamed out because it was kind of hard to get in there as a student. Came back home to Virginia in 2005, 2006. Worked a little bit and then kind of found my spark back in the fire service and volunteered at the James City Bruton Volunteer Fire Department in Toledo. Did that for about 3 or 4 years with some really close friends that I'm still close with. Some guys that you probably know well, Ricky Stone, it's in Henrico. Mm-hmm. Kept those friendships along the way. And then 3 or 4 years later, I was hired by Newport News Fire Department, which where I'm still at. I tested 3 times. It was the only fire department I wanted to work for because that's where I went to high school at, and eventually got on. That's back when you actually had to test multiple times to get hired somewhere. When it was hard to get picked up, it seems like times have changed a little bit on that. And I, after about 8 or 9 years, took a lieutenant's test, and now I'm a lieutenant on Engine 2, which is consistently one of the top two busiest engines in the city. My firehouse, we have 2 engines. We have Engine 2 and 201. An ambulance and the heavy rescue one. So I'm blessed. I have 11 people running out of my firehouse with 2 first-due engines, an ambulance, and then 3 guys on the rescue. So we can do quite a bit with what we have dispatched. And I think I've grown up a lot over my fire service career. Like you said, we used to have some debates. I'm not even sure if debates would quantify what some of the childish behavior I had in some of the disagreements, but you're right. It never ended poorly. It never ended on an uncivil note. And I think, growth is a good thing for everybody. And, we're so stagnant in what we learn in the fire service and kind of in our opinions. And the more I've read beyond the fire service and kind of getting into John Boyd, my eyes have opened up a lot into dissenting opinions and outside information and stuff like thermodynamics and physics and, chaos theory and game theory and mathematics, and even all the way down to stuff as far as like economics. A lot of guys that are in decision-making into economics and are economists, which is what Boyd studied originally in school. That's kind of where my journey's become. I went, still kind of an engine guru. You guys can have your truck stuff or your heavy rescue stuff. I'm still pretty much a basic guy putting water on the fire and heavily in the nozzles and hose stretches, which is what I started teaching off at. And then as I got promoted, I kind of saw some things in the fire service that were, I would say, are kind of neglected, kind of higher level thinking stuff. I think we tend to sensationalize the real basics. And people try to monopolize those kind of markets. And it's tough because even if I go to the department next door, they run different staffing. Their engines aren't stacked like mine is, so they can't really do a lot. So when I was teaching is I was telling guys how I do it. And that's really hard. The only one that can do it like I can do it is somebody that has 2 engines, an ambulance, and a rescue in their firehouse. And so that kind of started me down the path of, maybe let's try to find something that is worthwhile teaching everybody and can be applicable to everybody top down from, a 10,000 person department to a 10 person department. And I was reading Boyd for about 9 years and the light came on and I said, wait a minute, this is pretty applicable stuff. And it matches up with kind of the rabbit hole I went down after Nate Flynn died on the line of duty, in July, of 2018, and kind of ended up where I'm at now. And sometimes it seems like you're screaming into the void, and it's not necessarily the sexiest thing to talk about, but a very important topic I think in today's fire service.
Wholeheartedly agree, and just so many different rabbit holes we can go into off of your intro, and I love that. And hopefully we're going to get into all of them. The first thing I want to ask you about is, and again, because I'm from here, I understand, you know, the appeal of a Newport News, right? Like, I understand the appeal of that area, and I've talked about why I chose the fire department that I wanted to work in. Before we get into all the other stuff, like, just you know, explain to the listeners out there that maybe are unfamiliar with this little small but you know, small area city in Virginia, but truly like hopping area in Virginia when it comes to fire duty, when it comes to, you know, EMS runs and everything. Again, I'm familiar. My wife went to college in Newport News, so I've been bebopping around that area for a long time. But explain to the listeners, like, just what it means to work in the Newport News Fire Department and why the appeal there.
So Newport News Fire Department, usually people here, you know, call it Newport, and then, no, that's Rhode Island. Newport News is Virginia. It's in the southeast portion of Virginia. I guess they've called it 8 million things, from Tidewater to Hampton Roads, coastal Virginia. The easiest thing I can say is it's the city next to where Busch Gardens is, and it's across the river from where Virginia Beach is. Most people kind of understand that. Or if you've gone to the Outer Banks, it's the city before you go over the bridge tunnel. We're about 220,000 people nighttime. There's more than that. We have the only shipyard in America that builds our world-class aircraft carriers. And so that to ambulance, two battalions, all the way down the list. What drew me to Newport, in the city, very, it's got a lot of hit. It's, I would describe it as urban to urban sprawl. There's some areas where there's some mid-rises, you know, 20-story buildings, but nothing too crazy as far as high-rises go. We're pretty flat. But the city's irregularly shaped. You guys listened to Tony Carroll's Mayday Monday with some of the guys that were involved in Mayday not too long ago. It's pretty much shaped like a rectangle. There's 69 square miles, and there's two major roads that go. They're really west to east, but it's most people call them north to south, Jefferson Avenue and Warwick Boulevard, and there's crossovers throughout. And so it kind of a lot different than most cities that are square or rounded. So it's got a unique shape, and it's got unique cultures and neighborhoods all throughout it. And I remember just, you know, going to high school there, being drawn to the history and the diversity and, you know, just the people that live in that city. And through a mutual friend, her stepdad worked for the fire department, and talked to him a lot. And his passion for the district I'm in now, this is Station 2, really said, all right, well, you know, I think Newport News is where I want to work. And as I talked to more people that were had worked there and worked there currently, I knew it was where I wanted to work. So like I said, it took me 3 times to get on there, and I haven't looked back, and I love every minute of it. There's 11 stations. Where I work is downtown Station 2. We just celebrated our 120th year as a firehouse last year. All of our previous firehouses are still in existence. They're still, you know, they're in private ownership now, but we can trace our firehouse all the way back to one on just right down the street. And then there's a single engine firehouse, what we call the Tree Streets, and all named after trees, obviously. On the other side, that's old Station 5. So technically I have 4 firehouses in my first due with only 1 in active use. But I've been in 2 of the 3 that are no longer in existence. I've kind of taken on, you know, as my senior man who's got 38 years, and so you're kind of the historian of the district, and I try to find out about the buildings and the history behind it, because that stuff's important. You know, we're the keepers of the neighborhood longer than people live there, because, you know, the lifespan of people in most neighborhoods is, you know, the average lifespan of a human being. But now the fire department's been there for 120 years, so we pass that knowledge down. We can really be the history base of the neighborhood far longer than anybody that could ever be living there. So I'm just really blessed to work with where I work and who I work with. And I haven't taken any captain's test, because I kind of want to stay right where I am And I got a lot of stuff to finish as being a lieutenant. But the city's great. The people are fantastic. I live in, or I work in, I guess, kind of a more impoverished area of the city. And it feels nice to be able to give back to people that don't have much and to kind of be their rock, right? You know, when they don't have anybody else to call or they don't know who to call, they call the fire department. And, you know, night and day, no matter what happens, we're always there for them. And to take care of the people we swore to protect.
Yeah, like I said, and I think that's absolutely wonderful. And I'm always curious to why people choose what fire departments they work for. And I think a lot of the listeners are as well, right? Because, and I mean, you know, we both come from, in Virginia, very well-known fire departments, in the grave of the fire service. Like, very few people have heard of Henrico and Newport News, Virginia. And so I think it's important to talk about, you know, the passion that you have for Newport News. And again, knowing you, I know that that's there, right? I see your social
media.
I see all of those things, but just, you know, I think it's important for the listeners, because everyone talks about, like, you hear guys talk about from FDNY and DC and Seattle and all these major cities, and they talk about why they love working there. And I don't think that people like us push out enough, like, how great our own departments are. None of them perfect, obviously, but how great the areas we work in are and how vital they are, like you said, to that neighborhood, to, you know, station, you know, your engine two is vital to that neighborhood. It's been there longer than people have been alive living in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
I think some people get so wrapped up in name and size of departments. It's gotten to be the point where, well, I'm going to just, you know, and now with lateral transfers and lateral hires and state pension plans, people can jump ship. And I think it's really important, that people care about the fire department they work for and not look at it as just, you know, oh, just another job before you get hired. You know, it's easy to just say, oh, well, this person's offering me more money, but, you know, who brought you to the dance, right? Newport News took the opportunity to hire me and has done right by me my entire career. And I'm going to do right by them as I, you know, continue my career, and I'll end my career there. And I probably won't work anywhere else after I retire. I'll probably find a job doing something else. But so many people are so quick to jump because of the opportunities on social media and the ladder. And they don't take the time to really love their fire department. And you don't have to love the city government, and you don't have to love your admin. But when you take time to realize how much effort and love the people before you have put into that job to make your fire department special, to have the traditions you have, to have the colored rigs you have. You know, I've got guys, I'm friends on social media, they share their fire engines, and there's, you know, a couple guys from Northern Virginia, it's green, like a dark green. It's beautiful. Henrico, you know, they had that Henrico yellow or Henrico green for years. And then there's one, I think it's Peters Township Fire Department. It's like a mustard yellow and red. And they keep it because that's what they've had. And you know what? I don't like the mustard yellow, but I think it's a really cool tradition. And if I were there, I would love it just as much as they do. And that's important to own it and love it like it's a child, because it is, you know. You know, it'll never love you back, but, you know, put that time and effort in and you get a lot out of it.
Yeah, I totally agree. I totally agree with you. And like I said, I think it's important for people to just understand that, like, sometimes the best place that you're at is where you are, and try to make that best thing. But all right, let's, as we move different topics, I really want to get into this fire ground decision making stuff, and I really want to get to dive a little bit deeper into your perspective on fire ground decision making, because I feel it's a unique perspective, because a lot of people out there are, and I don't want to call it an antiquated way of decision making, but essentially it's like, you'll eventually learn it, right? Like, it's all on the job training, right? It's all like, all right, once you see enough fires, you'll understand how to make decisions. And I don't necessarily agree with that, right? I think that those things are important, right? You begin to develop your style maybe a little more through that, but your initial, like, introduction to decision making and fire ground decision making can't be the first time you ever go, or the fifth time you ever go. You have to have some sort of basis for it. And so you've kind of got a unique approach with taking the teachings of John Boyd and applying that to your fire ground decision making. Talk to me about, like how you came up with that and like why John Boyd and just like how you started to develop this unique view on fireground decision making.
So about 9 years ago, at the suggestion of Chris Brennan, I started. He was the one in charge of Fire Service Warrior and wrote Combat Position, which is still one of my favorite fire service books. Just incredible book. I don't think it gets enough play. He suggested we readers read Boyd, which is an autobiography by Robert Corum about John Boyd. Biography from Robert Corum about John Boyd. And it kind of got my mind working. I kind of related to him on a personal level. He was this gruff Air Force officer that kind of was like a my way or the highway kind of guy. And, you know, in my late 20s, early 30s, I kind of had that chip on my shoulder of, you know, renegade guy that's going to push against authority. Because, you know, in my fire department, we were very much fog nozzles and, you know, plastic helmets and no outside gear and things like that. And I wanted to be more traditional and wear the leather helmets and have the smoothbore nozzles. And so I kind of, you know, ran up against people that, and then, you know, even there are some disagreements about, you know, back in the day about slicers and transitional attack and all that stuff, you know, kind of the my way or the highway mentality. And that really resonated with me. So I just continued, you know, picking through Boyd and going down all sorts of books written by people about Boyd and then learning his lectures eventually. And then I kind of realized it wasn't that kind of attitude that I was identifying with. It was his thought processes and the way that he approached the world, that I was really identifying with. But it's, you know, sometimes it's much easier on face value to get caught up in these kind of characteristic traits. I kind of was really intrigued by his central thesis that, like, the whole world is rife with uncertainty. And in order to survive and thrive, we need to constantly be observing and orienting ourselves to our environment. And I kind of realized his thought process for fighter pilots was very applicable to us in the fire service. Now, his original OODA loop, which stands for Observe, Orient, Decide, Act, was meant for people in combat. So, you know, an adversarial kind of situation where you're against somebody, and he said, you know, those who can complete their OODA loop the fastest will win, because if you disorient or throw your opponent off, so that slows their OODA loop down, and you can complete yours faster, then you can get inside theirs and then kill them. But when you apply it of understanding that the OODA loop is just a basic mapping of how your mind already works without knowing it, the listeners do it thousands of times a day. They observe what they want. They orient themselves to the situation. You know, the easiest one is you wake up in the morning and you say, I'm hungry. Oh, you know what? It's not Sunday, so I can go to Chick-fil-A like I normally do and get a chicken biscuit and get a coffee, something like that. And so you decide which one you want to go to, and then you act on it. So it's a very simplistic, boiled down version of it, but very relatable for most people. So when you think of it that way, you really are already doing it. So when you can map it and understand and get behind the concepts, it's much easier to put together, and it's a very significant force multiplier when you can consciously go through it and then prepare yourself when you're actually faced with a situation. Now you can kind of unconsciously do it. You know, the fire service for years has taught linear decision-making. If X, then Y, then Y, then Z. And that's just not how things lay out. You know, bread and butter fires more often, okay, sure. But where you see us get in trouble are things that we've never gone to before. And it's really hard to apply those lessons, you know, from experience to things we haven't gone through before. And like you said, you put a new boss in this heat for the first day. Oh, you learn, kid. Okay, well, the first fire he goes to is a fire at, you know, some manufacturing plant. And he's never done that before. And so he just applies what he knows from residentials. And guess what? Bad things happen. And then we just say, okay, well, the fires and, you know, fire service is a dangerous job. We mourn them and we continue on. And that's not really how we should be facing it. You know, we should be teaching people to use these decision-making models, whether it's OODA or any of the other heuristics or national decision-making processes, to map things out and move forward. If we taught that more, I think you would see less catastrophic mistakes happen, or when they do, we'd be able to process them a little bit better. The fire service really pushed, you know, a lot of the mother may I culture as well, in saying that everything done is freelancing. And I think we've gone away from kind of a what Boyd calls maneuver-based organizations, which is setting the tone and setting the example and the expectations and the goals, and letting the subordinate leaders, the fire ground officers, do the work, instead of having a battalion chief that's sitting there with people on strings like puppets, and then having to ask him what to do. You know, he can set the tone. All right, we're in an offensive attack. All right, you know, with standing orders, everybody knows where they fill in. But the battalion chief shouldn't have to tell them, hey, pull the 400-foot pre-connect with a smoothbore nozzle and enter in through the seaside door. That only ruins your officer's ability to decision make, because as you do that, you take more independent action away from them than they never get the experience. And so eventually your leaders will have no decision-making experience and are just going to stand around and wait for people to tell them what to do. And I think we see that on a daily basis. I think we see that on EMS calls with certain officers and certain, you know, medics, that people said, well, only do what I tell you to do. So when time comes and hit, you know, the crap hits the fan, they're standing around twiddling their thumbs, because you know what? For 15 years, you told me not to do anything you didn't tell me to do, and now you need me to act because things are going haywire, and I don't have that ability. And so our linear decision-making processes with the control of certain fire ground officers has kind of skewed that. And I think it's time we bring it back and allow people to think critically and think openly and, you know, come up with new plans in their head, because you know, as things continue forward, as experience gets less and less, as fire departments get bigger that were traditionally smaller because people move away from cities, you're going to have an increase in these incidents where things go afoul. And it's not because they're not smart firefighters or tactically sound. It's just somebody made a poor decision, and then poor decisions followed afterwards. And it's time we kind of rein that back in, teach people how to do it, and square them away, you know.
No, I think you're 100% right. And it's an example that we have in my fire department, right? Like, we have what we call like tactical templates or a SORC deployment, where like engine one does X, engine two does X, engine three, four, and on down the line. And great for initial, like, and I all the time, like, that's great if you have no idea what to do. Right? Like, follow the SORC or whatever you want to call it, a tactical template, follow that. Like, it has to also be flexible. And we have so many like fire ground officers, and most of them, you know, and unfortunately some of them actually do have, you know, years of experience, right? They have years on the job. I don't know if they have years of experience, but they have years on the job, and they just continually follow that basic model. And when they're faced with something that doesn't fit that template, it throws them off and it delays fire ground operations. Right. And it's, yeah. You know, and sometimes it's as simple as hose line choice, right? Like, well, for the last 400 fires, I SORC and I pulled an inch and three quarter line, but now this is a fire that needs a 2.5 or needs a deck gun. And it's like, well, wait a minute. And it's not computing in their brain. Right. And so things.
Yeah. And it's, you know, and so the way that OODA loop is broken down, well, the way I like thinking it broken down is there's two ways to think about it. The implicit, which is, you know, the automatic, the way your brain does it all the time, and the explicit. And more often than not, we revert to that implicit because our brains are a lazy thing. Right? They want to take, you know, it's just like human beings. They want to expend the least amount of energy possible. And we like to talk crap on people or say they're stuck in the past, but a lot of people just do what they were trained to do. And so they pull this line that they've pulled hundreds of times, or they refer back to their standing operating guidelines, or what, you know, when you call them the SORC, I believe you said. And so what the OODA loop and what I try to train people to do is to have tactical patience. You know, I don't like to say slowing down because it sounds like I'm telling people to go slow, but I'm not. But have tactical patience and do, you know, a little bit of a slowdown, for lack of a better term. And use that explicitly and go through it and say, all right, is this line? All right, orient yourself to the situation. Nope, this isn't the appropriate line. I'm going to decide to use this, and then act, and then use the decision part as a hypothesis and the act as a testing. All right, well, I use this line. Is it getting better? Nope. All right, let's go to one of the other options that I had in the decision step and go to that one, revert back to it. And so you also learn through the, you know, the OODA loop as well, because you're learning what works and what doesn't work. And then when you come back, you know, you have to do a hard after action report, and you get everybody better. You know, that's part of creating that maneuver-based organization and understanding that, you know, me learning something is great, but if I can teach it to the whole organization or my whole officers and battalion levels, man, that's just, you know, the icing on the cake. And it may be something that's never been done before. You know, John Boyd had this concept of creating snowmobiles. And he talked about this mental model of you have, you know, the tank, treads on a tank, a motorboat, you know, picture somebody else skiing, somebody picture somebody on the lake, picture a boy playing with a tank, somebody on a bicycle. And he talks about breaking down the domains that connect those and building something out of that. And so you take the treads from the tank, the handlebars from the bike, you know, the motor from the motorboat, the outboard motor, the skis from the skier, and then you put them together, and what do you have? You've created a snowmobile. So you're taking bits and pieces of things from an already existing idea or item, and then putting them together in real time and creating something out of it. You know, and I know I got in a discussion not long ago, a relatively famous chief said that we don't do any creative thinking on the fire ground. And I would respectfully disagree. You know, that's the important part. When you have as many explicit guidelines and orders as that fire department does for as many situations that they face, yeah, okay, you may not need to think critically, but you also have, you know, 70 some guys on your first alarm, you can stop the fire out. But when you show up, you know, where I work part-time with two guys, with one driving, and you've got the paper mill on fire in West Point, guess what? It's creative thinking time. And to tell anybody that law enforcement, fire, and military don't think creatively and don't decision-make in the moment is just an incorrect statement. And we need to get to that point where we do it more and encourage intellectual thought and creativeness amongst our firefighters and officers. And, you know, I hope I teach my guys that they should be doing it too. And then part of my orientation is stuff that they bring up to me. I should never be closed off in a system where I'm not getting outside information into me. And part of that's guys, you know, telling me stuff. You know, a lot of officers don't want to hear that. But if your firefighter says, hey, LT, it's getting hot, or hey, how about we go down here? Don't be so stubborn to think you're the only one processing information. Bring that in and, you know, bring it forward. Sorry, it's allergy season, so I had to clear my throat a little bit.
Season and it's, I totally understand. I get it.
Yeah, yellow stuff everywhere in a few weeks. You know, and really open yourself out to that in information. And when it becomes part of your organization, it's easier because subordinates and, you know, your officers are open to all sorts of information and ideas. It's no longer a closed loop. You know, John Boyd called it entropy, which is the energy of doing work. And so when you have a closed system, entropy builds up, and it's just like a motor without air coming in, right? What happens in an enclosed space with a motor? It gets hot and it stops working. So eventually, if you don't have an open system where you're bringing information or ideas in and out, that system's going to overheat and shut down, whether it's the organization, whether it's your operations on the fire ground. You know, imagine being in a burning building and not having, you know, contact with the outside. I mean, how many times have we seen the video where the engine officer is like, no, chief, we got it. And, you know, there's fire out three or four floors above him because he doesn't see the whole picture. He's trapped off from that outside information. So if you don't have that, things go terribly wrong. And so building that as part of your unit information, and then more importantly, as part of the organization, gets much, much better in the decision-making process. So I'm glad I didn't respond directly to that chief that's so revered, but I think sometimes, and I'm going to go off on a tangent here, we have like sacred cows in the fire service and some things that we don't want to bring up. And I think that's starting to do a disservice to us and firefighters, because we don't want to, you know, we take everything they say as gospel, and that's not true. You know, Boyd had this statement that, you know, you don't let doctrine become dogma. So doctrine is like your standard operating procedures. You know, that's what pretty much what they have in the military. And dogma is, you know, religious fact, right? It's indisputable. So you never want that stuff to become indisputable. You always want to be questioning information. But it seems like in the fire service today, if you're well known enough or you come up from a big enough department, no matter what you say, it's infallible. And then you say something that somebody jumps down your throat and it just becomes like a bashing of somebody based on somebody's cult of personality fighting their wars. And there's some guys that actively seek out to cause disagreements or, you know, cause arguments on behalf of these sacred cows in the fire service. And they actively say, oh, you're going against this guy. No, man, I'm just saying my opinion. Relax. You know, great. He's here. He's got that. That's fantastic. That's not the real world, or that's not how everywhere else is. And everybody's entitled to how they do it. And everybody's entitled to have their own experiences and background. And that's how we grow. The moment we start saying that there's only one way to do things, we've gone terribly wrong as a fire service.
I'm glad you brought that up because, and I know the exact, what you're talking about, that exact person that you're talking about had an experience, currently a book by another very well, renowned chief officer from that same fire department. As I'm reading this book, I just find myself like just disagreeing with some of the things that he says in the book. Right. And it just is like, and it's not that he's wrong, but they don't necessarily apply to me, right?
Exactly.
Or they apply to what we're doing or how we do business or how we operate. He's not necessarily wrong, but it's just, it's, and I'm glad you said that. Like we, you're exactly right. We do keep these guys on a pedestal and everything they say, we just are like, oh, we treat it as it's the only thing. And we've got to get away with that. And I'm glad you get away from that.
And a lot of, I would say, you know, 75 to 80% of what they say is fantastic. And, you know, I appreciate them putting it out there. The problem lies in how we react to it, just like everything else in the world. People need to realize that these are opinions, right? Nothing's a true fact. You know, it's all in how you orient to things and how you observe things. Me and you could see the same exact thing, but because of the way our brains are wired, it may be processed differently within our heads. And so, we need to gather as much information from as many sources as possible. And that's the only true way we can get a good picture of things. But just to say that one department's way or one chief officer or one guy's way of doing things is right, is not the way. Even like science, right? Like there's science isn't definite. You know, it's not provable. You know, there's no way you can prove that it's right. It's just an experiment that you're recreating. So when you realize that everything's kind of hard to quantify and kind of flexible, when you start getting into like higher level, you know, physics and math and stuff like that, and you start looking about like the uncertainty, Heisenberg's uncertainty, theory and, other uncertainty things, you know, it really kind of opens your brain to say, all right, well, I'm taking what you said and that's great. But there's more to it. You know, you look at like Gödel's incompleteness theorem that pretty much tripped the whole math world. Like everybody thinks math is math. but, you know, it's pretty much says, you know, the first incompleteness theorem says that any formal system, which are like just a set of rules for doing math, there will always be some true statements about numbers that we can't prove within that system. So, you can't prove that it's true. There's always things that we know, but we won't be able to prove that they're right. You know, just like uncertainty principle. You know, you can never precisely know where something is and how fast it's going at the same time. So like, I can tell you where the plane is, but I can't tell you how fast it's going and vice versa, because by the time I tell you where it is, guess what happened? It's moved, right? And so these things, as you go deeper into things, in the understanding, the more nebulous opinions become, and the more you are open to, you know, everybody's input and just saying, listen, everybody's right in their own way. It just needs to be, you know, well, he's right when you have 20 guys showing up on a first alarm, and he might be right when you've got, you know, 14 tower ladders and 70 guys showing up, and five on each apparatus. And the more we come to that and say, if we can just round table more and talk, get off of the confines of social media, the better we'll be at. Because, you know, there was a battalion chief from San Diego that I disagreed with vehemently for years on social media, Lane Woolery. Yeah. And I mean, it sometimes got a little mean spirit comes with that. We can talk. That's the to at a conference and realize that the we're starting how his whereas my you can sit down, read facials, and intent things through in the lights in the same language. It's a translation talk instead of getting pissed off for an hour and then check in, and that person is replying and you know, back and forth. But you start to, again, your opinion of what that person, apply your tone. Oh, he's being an asshole. Maybe he's not being an asshole. Maybe he's just trying to tell you how they do the things. And if you read it in a more positive tone, maybe you'll get more out of it than think of it as him being critical. And the world needs more of that. And I'll be the first one to admit that I was probably one of the worst at that at social media. And getting into this stuff has really enlightened me to how to react to people and improve my life as a leader, as a person, as a father, as a husband, and all these other things. Just understanding there's so much out there we don't know. There's so many different ways to look at things. There's so many biases in your head and the way that you're skewed to understand things that there's a reason why you're disagreeing with somebody, even though you're looking at the same exact thing.
Yeah, it's to me, it's kind of two things with that. It's like, that's why I've always really appreciated John Norman taking one of his classes. He'll put up like a picture of a fire and he'll go, you know, people always ask me like how I'm going to attack this fire. And I always tell them it depends. Because if you attack it this way, because you, like you said, tower ladders, 300 people coming. He's like, but in the volunteer department that he grew up in, where there's two engines and a mutual aid engine coming, he's going to attack that fire completely different. And if you try to apply those, you know, big city tactics in a rural environment, like you talked about with your part-time department, you know, that's you're going to fail. And you're going to be like, well, wow, you know, FDNY or DC or, you know, insert big name fire department here does this. You know, why didn't it work for me? And it's like, well, because you're not in the same arena. You're not even playing the same sport. And yeah. I really, really appreciate that. And it also your social media stuff. It always makes me think of that Key and Peele skit where they're texting each other. One of them's mad, and one of them wants to fight, and the other one's just like chilling out playing video games. Like, it's very hard to get context over social media.
Oh, it is. You know, and I think once again we just say, hey, we're just talking. You know, there's no tone to it, but we've become so adversarial in nature as human beings that we just assume out the gate that it's confrontational, and it does us a disservice. But you're right, Norman is just fantastic. He's so pragmatic in the way he approaches things. Timmy Klett's the same way. You know, it's hard for me sometimes to remember who I'm talking to if I go teach, and it's a smaller rural department, even though I run part-time at a small department. In the town that I live in, this town of 3,000 people, there's sometimes we go to fire calls that are 30 minutes away with no hydrants. You know, people couldn't imagine, you know, 30 minutes to get on scene to a burning building, and you're getting, you know, you have to tell dispatch what you want from the surrounding communities on automatic aid because they just don't have run sheets, you know. So it's a whole different world. And like I said, you show up with a driver who's also a paid part-timer and yourself. And you might have a volunteer in the back that has nothing, and you might not. Or, you know, you go on an EMS call, and I may have a guy that's a driver. He's got EVAC and CPR, and that's it. And so I've got to maintain a critical patient 40 minutes to the VCU in Richmond, you know, by myself, which is just not something, you know, we do in the city of Newport News. You know, we've got hospitals 5 and 10 minutes away, and everybody's ALS. So it's just a different world. And once you can, you know, I wish people could kind of see that and branch out. And the guys that teach that are bigger name departments really have an impact with that, you know, volunteer experience, or they've maintained a close contact with their volunteer roots or their, you know, part-time roots as they've gone up the ladder really, really helps. You know, there's so many guys like, you know, Kurt Isaacson does a great job of understanding you know, what it takes between the big places and the small places, because he's, you know, kind of in a smaller place. The Scambia is not necessarily, you know, the biggest place in the world. And so it helps. But I think a lot of guys still need that, you know, to go ride along. As much as people want to ride with big cities, go to your local volunteer department, talk to these guys, go to these small towns. It's mind-blowing, the world that some of these people operate in. And when you realize that, like, hey, man, when they were talking about slicers and transitional attacks, they probably weren't talking to your urban / suburban fire department. They were probably talking to the guy that shows up 45 minutes in and there's fire blowing out three or four windows and he shows up with two guys. You know, when you realize that, it's like, oh, maybe I shouldn't fight this and just say, okay, it works when necessary. And it's like, oh, wait a minute, that's what we were talking about the whole time. But we just, you know, we co-opted this whole thing and created a whole movement out of it so we can make memes and get social media presence and you know, get that that dopamine rush by having people agree with us on social media.
Yeah, you're 100% right, and I laugh at it just because, like, you know, of course, like, everyone saw that stuff, but you're 100% right. So let's dive into that a little bit. Let's take in the means of Fireground decision making. Let's talk about, you know, Kyle, the lieutenant of Engine 2, and Kyle, the part-time firefighter for the part-time small fire department with two people. Is the OODA loop or your Fireground decision making model, do you apply them the same way? And if so, how? And if they're different, try and explain how they're different so that, you know, like, again, that urban boss or that rural boss can apply that Fireground decision model and apply it to their situation.
So the main difference for me is going back to that explicit and implicit loop. So I see far more fires in Newport News than I do in West Point, right? So more often than not, my implicit OODA loop, or as John Boyd called it, the implicit guidance and control arm, pretty much goes from orient right to act. I don't have to decide what to do because I already know from previous experience and matching it with what I'm currently seeing that this is the next step, right? It's more of that kind of like RPDM or RPD, you know, recognition, prior decision making. That's kind of the same kind of thing. So you see it, you know it, you do what you got to do. Part-time, because I'm just not used to barn fires, or, you know, a tractor that's on fire next to acetylene torches, you know, next to the house or something like that, I have to slow down and really make a concerted effort to be like, all right, what am I seeing? What am I not seeing? Which is also very important. How is my bias towards, you know, being a little bit more aggressive because of my full-time job? How is that skewing things? How should I be fighting this and then come up with a couple outcomes and then decide and then see if they work and then use the feedback loops to see if it continues the work? You know, like, we went to a barn fire with two volunteers in the back, and it was fully involved. You could hear the acetylene torches blowing the safety valves off inside. And it was spreading to the brush, to multiple vehicles next to it, including some flatbed trucks. And it was probably 10 feet from the house. And we just kind of had to, you know, no hydrants. So we had to call for a tanker task force and kind of make our line in the sand and say, all right, well, we can burn all the brush at once, but the house is the most valuable thing. You know, and then our lives next to the assembly torches, how are we, you know, the bottles, how are we going to set up so, you know, they decide to go, we're more, you know, most protected. And so, you know, you just kind of be a little bit more explicit through that. And so using the loops to your advantage really benefits people, and understanding in the detail behind it and how your vision works, you know, it even goes down to the biology of your body and understanding what you miss, you know, really saying, all right, it's on fire, I'm gonna move my eyes, because your brain will process the life threat, because genetically, in your genetic heritage, you're primed to do that. So you don't need to be a monitor to the fire, because your brain will map it, say, hey, look, it's there. And then maybe you'll catch the chimney next to the house that's really tilted, that may be the thing that ends up being the most significant, you know, threat to everybody operating outside, not necessarily the fire coming out the window, you know, and using those things to take advantage of your situation. And yeah, the more you can go through it, the better you get. And just following your natural, you know, thought process already when you're decision-making, no matter the situation you end up in, you know, you can either, you know, slow it right and, you know, go full speed, or you know, use a little tactical patience and slow it down. And the same thing for like Newport News. If I were to go to a fire at the shipyard, that's not something we do. You know, and that would involve radioactive materials and classified documents and people that I haven't worked with before, because the shipyard has their own fire department. And it's, again, it's that time to all right, let's downshift a little bit, see what we got. Let's orient ourselves. Why am, you know, should I apply the tactics I know from residentials to this? Why and why not? And, you know, it happens in a second. We don't want to take minutes here, but you know, the more you can do it beforehand, the better. And when you comes time, the heat of the moment, you're able to process it very quickly and go through your OODA loop and get your feedback loops and then gauge how you're performing and seeing if you need to change tactics or if what you're doing is working and continue on.
Yeah, so, and I didn't mean to cut you off there, but like the what you said a couple things that really like sparked my brain when you said that. And I really think where you talked about using that feedback, right? Getting the feedback and processing that information. I see that as probably one of the biggest, and I don't want to call it failures, but maybe obstacles in our fireground decision-making, right? Like we get so in love with our first choice and we're going to make that work, right? And then we don't process that feedback that feedback loop or that information coming to us in either fast enough, or we just kind of ignore it because like, nope, there's no way I could be wrong. This is right because it worked on so many other fires and everything like that. And I really, really like that. That is, I think that is like kind of the core of everything that you're talking about is it really is. And the other thing I wanted to kind of ask you, and if you wouldn't mind commenting on how to maybe like give us some tips on how to process that information better, but also talk about, you said something about the more you can do beforehand. Talk about, I know people talk about pre-planning and training and stuff like that, but talk about how we can utilize some of that to increase our decision-making efficiency.
So I always tell people you want to remove as many decisions as you can beforehand, right? So, you know, anything you can reduce the amount of mental, I guess, you know, memory needed to act in the moment. So you can only really handle 3 to 7 things at a time. That's why ICS kind of tells that 3 to 7 things, you know, ideally 5. And there's a reason for that, because the brain can only process that many things at once. No matter how good you think you are, no matter how experienced a fire ground officer you are, that's the honest truth. The brain has a limit to what it comprehends. So the last thing you want to do before you get there is have to say, all right, Johnny's riding in the back. Johnny, you've got the nozzle now, and I want you to pull 1¾ inches with a smoothbore nozzle off the officer's side and bring it around here. You know, we're going through the A door. And it's the reason why I have a playbook for my guys when they come down and they ride my engine. Everybody knows what they do on every call. It's a loose framework, right? But it gives them autonomy to do what needs to be done. Hey, this is your riding position. This is what we prefer. This is our language, right? So it has common terms and it defines them. And so if I say this, this is what that means. So we don't have to guess. We don't have to be ambiguous. We don't have to figure out in the moment. All we have to do in the moment is figure out the fire problem. Because what we don't know before the fire, you know, gets toned out is what building it's in, how much is on fire, and what's inside the building. And if we can focus on those 3 things when we get there, it's a whole lot easier than have to figure out everything else. And you can tell the people that have standing orders before they get there, or, you know, not necessarily just as a fire department, but even amongst their crews, because they just go to work. You know, they don't have to yell out what goes here, what goes there, or anything like that. They don't have to say where the hydrant is. All right, great. The second dude's got the plug. He's going to bring it me water. I don't have to worry about that. Now my brain's freed up to process something else. And you can always tell on the radio the company that doesn't have that. And it's always the fires where you're listening and you go, something's about to go wrong. And you can just feel it because they're just verbalizing too much and they're not worried about the fire problem, which is what we're there to worry about. Their minds are on other things. And when your mind goes to something else, you're shot. You know, you just can't be in the moment the way you are. So the more you can preload on the front end, that's why I don't agree with multiple length crosslays, right? If you're going to have crosslays, they need to be the same. Now, if you have something off the back, obviously, yeah, you can have multiple off the back, and that's easy. But don't just say, well, you know, hey, this is the one we're going to pull. There's too many examples of hose lines getting pulled. You know, today's the anniversary of Oscar Armstrong fire, and that's a perfect example of pulling the wrong way. You know, there was a fire in Fairfax a couple of years ago that they pulled the cross light that was closest to the building just because it was the closest, but it also ended up being the longest. So they had a bunch of hose in the front yard that really jammed them up. And it would have been more advantageous to go around the other side and pull the shorter free connect. But, you know, just those things of eliminating all those choices in the moment. Sorry, my puppy's whimpering, so I need to let him out. A puppy, he's a horse. He's a great Pyrenees, but he's a generalist. Doing those things in the moment are too much. So the more you front load him, that I don't have to tell the backstep guy, I'm freed up to make so many more decisions that are actually need to be done. And, you know, I think we lessen the potential of things going wrong. Pre-planning is the same way, right? If we pre-plan our buildings, especially commercials, where, you know, let's be honest with ourselves, more firefighters get killed, in those kind of buildings than anything, higher percentage, I should say, right? Not more, but we go to less commercial buildings, but the percentage of firefighters killed in commercial buildings is higher than anywhere else. And that's because they present, you know, threats and issues that are different than any other building we go to. We go to in and out of houses all day on EMS calls, on fire alarms, on smells and bells, on electrical problems, on lift assist, et cetera. But we don't get into the Dollar General. We don't get into the Lowe's. When you get there and it's on fire, it's a game changer. And so going out and pre-planning them is essential, or just at least maybe just getting out and understanding, hey, this is where the fire load's at. You know, I can't tell you how many times you see people at commercials and on fire, and they all go through the front door. And when you start thinking about what can catch fire in a lot of these buildings, almost everything's in the back. And more often than not, that's where the fire is. And now you're stretching a 200-foot pre-connect, or now, you know, a leader line or something like that through aisles to get to the back. And you just get jammed up. And so, you know, pre-planning that and having those go-to plans before the bell goes off really allows you to just get on scene and go through your OODA loop faster and process things at a much better speed than everybody else.
Man, fantastic. And that's exact home run. That's exactly what I was hoping you were going to say. So just fantastic. And I think it's very valuable for the listeners to hear that, right? Like it's applicable and, you know, pre-planning is important. Getting out there is important. Training is important. All these things, trying to minimize those decision-making opportunities to get through that loop fast. Just spot on 100%. As we start to wind down, talk to me about Pragmatic Fire Consulting. Like, how can people get a hold of that? And then talk about any classes that you've got coming up and how people can get a hold of you if they want to dive deeper, get you to come out and teach your class. Because I believe your class is called Mind of Fire, right? Like, when you're talking about all this topic for a long time and really, really, really getting down into detail. So talk about how they can come hear Mind of Fire, talk about Pragmatic Fire Consulting, and how people can get a hold of you.
So the company's Pragmatic Fire Consulting, like you said. I love that term, pragmatic. You know, you can head to my website, mindoffire.com. And for those that are unfamiliar, pragmatic is just a practical approach to problem solving and decision making, focusing on what's feasible and effective rather than like idealistic, right? So we want to worry about our results and not like perfect ways to achieve things, because we'll never get perfect, right? We want like most appropriate. And so that's part of the decision making process that we go through, is if we wait for perfect, the situation's unfolded and we're already far behind. But the fire service has kind of wanted to get there, and that's just not realistic. So if you head to mindoffire.com, you can see classes, you can see all about, you can get contact, our email's on there. info@mindoffire.com is the email address. You see a description of all our classes, the Mind of Fire, which is the decision-making in high-risk events. I still have my Estimating the Stretch class, which is a two-hour class on understanding the basics of hose work and stuff like that. Maneuver, which is the back end of Mind of Fire, which is a two-hour class on creating an organizational climate for operational success. And that focuses on the four tenets of trust, intuitive skill, focus, and mission, which is what makes a maneuver-based organization function, which is what John Boyd was a fan of. And you start talking about lean production models and what Toyota does and empowering employees and really making the organization move forward at a more productive pace. And then what I don't do much anymore, but it's called Big Drops of Water, which is a two-hour class. It's a case for smoothbore nozzles. I think that people have kind of come to the understanding of how effective they are at this point between what Laguerre is putting out and what other people are doing. Kyle Romagus, those folks, they kind of understand that now. So that's kind of backed away a little bit, but it's still out there if people want to do it. There's also a blog on the website. Just a lot of the stuff we share from Facebook, also active on Facebook, Pragmatic Fire Consulting. And then you could also come probably late spring, early summer. My book will be available for purchase. There'll be a link on the website and then the Facebook. The book's called Mind of Fire, Decision-Making on the Fire Ground. It's not published by anybody but myself. No one really cares enough. I'd be surprised if I should, you know, sell like two copies. But it's just higher level nerd stuff, and it's a deep dive into why the OODA loop, what it is, splitting it between the implicit and the explicit, how we can use it to form a better organization, how we can get it to decision make better. It'll be about 200 to 250 pages. And it's got like fire ground examples, so it's not just all higher level thinking. And it's made for people to read, put down, think about, and come back to it. The class is kind of a highlight of what the book is. And the only reason I wrote the book is because when you research something for 9 years, folks will know this, that put a lot of research and time into things. It just stays in your head. And it's hard to get out, and you constantly think about it and you're constantly processing with it. And so, you know, you don't want that rounds every day. And so it was very helpful for me to put it into a book format and put those into words and have it out there. So when people take the class and they're come away intrigued, they can know the why and the what and the deep dive behind it. Because just hearing it out loud, it's very heavy. It's very technical. So it makes it much easier for them to have it in book form, read it, kind of sit on it, and then pick it back up as opposed to anything else. I'm also on Twitter. At Kyle, I think it's Kyle Sampson, K-I-E-L, might be underscore. Hold on, it's been a while since I've looked at my own Twitter handle. Kyle underscore K-I-E-L underscore Sampson, S-A-M-S-I-N-G. I interact with a fantastic group of individuals on there and kind of call ourselves Fire Twitter. You know, I've gotten close to some really amazing people from big departments to small departments and everything in between, and just understanding how much is out there. Hold on, baby. Sorry, my daughter. I see. Go see mama, okay? Seeing how much is out there and seeing how important it is for different ideas. I've got a class coming up in August. I'm doing the South Atlantic Fire Rescue Expo, Safer in North Carolina. I'm teaching on Wednesday, Mind of Fire. It's a four-hour lecture class, a pre-conference workshop. And then I'm also teaching with Greg Wheeler and Jason Joannides. On Friday, we're doing like a walk around building construction, and Jason's going to talk about truck work and how to deal with this construction stuff. And Greg and I will hit on some engine stuff. And then Greg is also pretty handy. He just built his own house about building construction stuff. So it's kind of going to be a good, well-rounded thing. It'll be going to be a lot of fun just walking around downtown Raleigh. Not sure if I want to do that in August, but it'll be fun nonetheless. And then I've got a few things in the works for the fall. If you guys are unfamiliar with me, I try to limit myself on how many things I've done. Usually in the past couple of years, it's been one to two things. This year, I'm going to open it up to a little bit more. And the reason for that is my family. I've got two young kids. This year, they'll be 2 and 4. So they're kind of growing up a little bit. But I try not to be away from them too much. I don't work much overtime. Like I said, one to two things a year, maybe do 3 to 5 this year. But if at all possible, I usually try to bring my kids and my wife with me and kind of turn it into a little family event before the lecture. And then I'll do my thing and then come back. And, it's fun. It's, we've been to Florida and New York and a couple other places, and hoping to have a few more this year. We'll see what happens. You know, people always reach out, and then it takes a little bit if you guys aren't familiar with that process. But if you guys are interested, head to Mind of Fire or email me at info@mindoffire or kyle@mindoffire.com, and we can talk pricing and logistics and all that stuff. It's a good time. It's higher level. I recommend it for officers and officer development. I'm setting up a class right now. It's a 3-day flip-flop for departments, all three shifts. I'm going to go down there and teach all their three shifts decision making and using this and getting them on a similar mind, you know, mindset so they can all use and become more of a maneuver based organization. Because it's far easier if all the officers speak the same language. So, you know, if me and the guy next to me in the department all know what the other is going to do, I don't have to tell him. You know, I do this, I know he's going to react a certain way, and he's lock and step behind me, and things flow a lot smoother that way as you move through an event. So the more you can be on the same page, you know, even down to decision-making, the better the outcomes and the better the environment for the fire department.
Man, fantastic. And so all you guys listening out there, make sure that you themindoffire.com, go to the Facebook page, the Pragmatic Fire Consulting, get a hold of Kyle. Like if this is any, you know, just preview of how much he's really delved into this topic and developed it and researched it and put it in and made it applicable for the fire service. Like, you know, I don't know if there's anybody doing anything quite similar to this, to be quite honest with you. I'm looking forward to the book. So he's going to sell a copy to me.
Great.
The book. I really am, especially with reading your stuff on Facebook and just your perspective. Again, it's unique, I think. And I think uniqueness is what we're moving forward in the fire service. So Kyle, thanks for joining us and stay tuned for some closing remarks from the Average Jake Firefighter Podcast.
What a tremendous conversation with Kyle Samsing. I mean, like I said at the very beginning, just a unique thinker, a unique take on fire ground decision making, and applying that OODA loop, that John Boyd loop, whatever you want to call it, to the fire service. And he just had so many examples of how we can utilize that to make sure people are making good decisions from the outset of their career and the outset of being an officer, the outset of being a firefighter. Just tremendous, tremendous stuff. I know I'm going to buy that book. I'm very interested to get to that, and I'd like to make it out to one of his classes because I think it's going to be, again, we need uniqueness in the fire service. We need uniqueness. We need unique thinkers because we are dealing these days with unique problems. The building construction, the fire behavior, you know, like what FDNY is experiencing right now with e-bike fires, right? Like they've had to think outside the box a little bit when it comes to how they're handling these things, because the fire behavior is so fast, so rapid, and violent. They're having to think outside the box with some of their tactics that they're using, and that's the kind of the world we're living in, right? Like we have to think more unique. The bread and butter fires are still there, and some of that, you know, A, B, C, D decision making works. But on the tough ones, on the ones that are outside a single line of fire, you know, or a single attack line rather, that's where we need to be more unique thinkers, and we need to have a better decision making model. And I think Kyle is definitely one of those at the forefront of that. And so I hope you go visit Pragmatic Fire Consulting on Facebook. Go visit mindoffire.com and really start to delve into some of this stuff. And when his book comes out here in the next couple months, I hope we get on there and we sell that thing out. He thinks he's only going to sell a couple copies. I hope he sells thousands, because I think it's very beneficial to what we're moving forward. And so with that being said, I couldn't do what I do without the help of some great companies. We talked about this in the intro, but I couldn't do what I do without great people that are continuing to support me, support the podcast, encourage me to record, all of those things. The first being Vanguard Safety Wear. Vanguard Safety Wear, the makers of the MK1 Fire Glove. Those things are made for work. I wear the MK1 Ultras every day that I'm at work. There's the squad ones, the regular MK1s. They're just everything out there. You know, they're some of the best fire gloves on the market. And they're tough. They last forever. But even when they wear out, you're going to want to buy another pair because they're that daggone good. So go to VanguardSafetyWear.com or DingusFire.com and get you a set of Vanguard Safety Wear MK1 Squad Ones or the MK1 Ultras. Vanguard Safety Wear, made for work. The next being Taylor's Tens. Taylor's Tens, makers of metal helmet fronts, but they make so much more than that. They make metal front locker tags, helmet fronts, play-in cards, pump cards, four-gas monitor cards, everything under the sun. If you can think it, they can probably make it for you. So go to taylorstens.com. That's taylorstens.com. And stop burning up leather helmets. Start wearing Taylor's Tens. The next, IDLH Technology, tacticalworksheet.com. makers of, in my opinion, the absolute best command boards on the market. I love those things. I've got the IDLH command board. I've got the IDLH mini command board. I've got the IDLH active shooter command board with an MCI tab on it. They are awesome. I just utilized, I think I said this on the last podcast, but just the other day, I utilized my IDLH mini command board that I keep in my jacket pocket, the inside jacket pocket. I utilized that because I was operating in a forward position on a brush fire, and they were assigning me units, and I had no way to keep track of them until I pulled out my IDLH Tactical Command Board Mini. And now I'm writing units down. I'm writing where they're at. I can even draw on the back and put where like the flanks and the head of the fire and the heel of the fire is, all of those things. It was fantastic. I was able to keep control and accountability while still operating in a forward position. I absolutely love their products. Go to tacticalworksheet.com. That is tacticalworksheet.com. And see all the cool products that Andy has on the website for you. He's even starting to develop one for tablets that he's going to hopefully be releasing very shortly. It's just fantastic stuff that he's doing with command boards. And he's a firefighter. He's a command officer. These are firefighter products. These are from the brain of a guy who's commanding fires and can really get into what we really need as command officers on the fire ground. So again, tacticalworksheet.com. Go get some of the best command boards and command accountability boards on the market. And lastly, the Fireground Commander Conference, May 8th, 9th, and 10th, Henrico Theater, Henrico County, Virginia. Such a tremendous lineup that we have. This is going to be our sixth conference, and we have brought over 40 national level speakers to the Metro Richmond area, but there's plenty of opportunity to come in and join us. It's a Metro Richmond area conference, but we take people from everywhere. There's an airport literally less than a mile from the venue. There's nothing but hotels all in and around. We're going to have two socials. That's right, two socials. We're working on nailing down the first one, but we know that the second one's going to be at our local Union Hall, Henrico Firefighters Local 1568. They're going to be hosting us on Tuesday night. The Monday social is going to happen. We're just trying to nail down the venue, but that's going to be two socials this year. Normally we only have one, and it's going to be even more opportunity for you to interact with the speakers. The Henrico Theater is a beautiful venue, and you get lunch all day, every day, snacks run by the Richmond Fire Squad, Richmond Flying Squad, and we provide those all 3 days. 10 speakers for $175. That's the best value in the country. I dare you to go and find a conference that's giving you all that production value, socials, speakers, venue, food every day, snacks and coffee and drinks all day every day for $175. $175 investment in yourself. You want to join us? Of course you do. Go to embracetheresistance.com. That's embracetheresistance.com. Click on the conference tab, and then you'll be on your steps and on your way to joining us for the 6th Fireground Commander Conference, May 8th, 9th, and 10th, 2023, Henrico Theater, Henrico County, Virginia. And lastly, you know what we do. Make sure you're spending 1 hour every day getting in the gym, working on your physical fitness to do the job that you swore you'd be able to do. Make sure you're spending 1 hour a day in the library, studying, learning, reading about the job that we're supposed to be doing, watching YouTube videos, studying fire behavior, studying fireground decision making, reading non-fire service stuff like Kyle talked about to enhance your mental capacity so that you can process information faster, and spend 1 hour a day putting your hands on the tools and equipment that we need to do our job, 1 hour hands-on training. You do that, you'll become a pretty phenomenal firefighter, I guarantee it. Thanks for reading. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. Stay aggressive. Out.